Number 1. Denise Williams. She was the picture of a devoted wife and mother, a church-going woman with deep ties to her Florida community. But behind that wholesome image, prosecutors said, was a carefully calculated plan to get rid of her husband and cash in on his life insurance. Her name is Denise Williams, and in 2018 she was convicted of orchestrating one of Florida's most shocking murder-for-money cases. The victim was Mike Williams, Denise's high school sweetheart and husband. On December 16, 2000, Mike went out duck hunting on Lake Seminole near Tallahassee. When he didn't return, his boat was found abandoned. Inside were his shotgun and gear. Authorities assumed he had drowned in a hunting accident, his body lost to the waters. In the following weeks, a massive search was conducted, but no body was ever recovered. Denise played the role of grieving widow. She petitioned for her husband to be declared dead by accident, and within months, she collected nearly $1.75 million in life insurance payouts. Friends and family mourned Mike, but Denise quickly began a relationship with Brian Winchester, Mike's longtime friend and insurance agent, the very man who had sold Mike those policies. By 2005, Denise and Brian were married. For years, the case remained a mystery. Then in 2016, the story unraveled. Denise and Brian's marriage fell apart. In a desperate move, Brian kidnapped Denise at gunpoint, leading to his arrest. Facing charges, he struck a deal with prosecutors. He admitted what really happened to Mike Williams on that December morning in 2000. According to Winchester, there was never an accident. The trip to Lake Seminole had been a setup. He testified that he pushed Mike into the water, expecting him to drown. When Mike struggled to stay afloat in his waders, Brian shot him in the head at Denise's urging. Together, they had plotted the murder so she could claim the insurance money and so they could be together. In December 2017, Denise Williams was arrested and charged with first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit murder, and accessory after the fact. Her trial drew national attention. Prosecutors argued she had been the mastermind, pointing to her swift collection of the insurance money, her secret affair with Winchester, and her cold detachment in the years after Mike's disappearance. Denise maintained her innocence, claiming Brian had acted alone, but the jury believed Winchester's testimony. In December 2018, she was convicted on all counts and sentenced to life in prison without parole for murder, plus additional years for conspiracy and accessory charges. For nearly two decades, Mike Williams' disappearance had been a mystery whispered about in Tallahassee until the truth came out. A wife, her lover, and an insurance policy worth millions. Denise Williams is now serving her life sentence at a Florida women's prison, her name forever tied to the betrayal and killing of the man who trusted her most. Number 2. Susan Wright. She was the young Texas mother who claimed she had been a victim of abuse. Prosecutors said she was a cold-blooded killer who stabbed her husband almost 200 times for money. Her name is Susan Wright, and her trial became one of the most sensational in Houston's history. Susan was born in 1976, and by her mid-20s, she was married to Jeff Wright, a 24-year-old aspiring boxer and father of their two young children. Outwardly, the couple seemed normal, a working-class family in Houston. But inside their home, arguments and accusations of abuse were common. Susan later claimed Jeff was violent, both physically and sexually, and that years of mistreatment drove her to the breaking point. On the night of January 13, 2003, everything erupted. While their children slept in another room, Susan tied Jeff to their bed with neckties and ropes. What happened next shocked even veteran investigators. Susan stabbed her husband 193 times with a kitchen knife, striking his chest, his head, and his neck until he was dead. She then tried to clean the scene, painting over the bedroom walls to hide the blood, and buried Jeff's body in a shallow grave in their backyard. At first, Susan tried to maintain the appearance of a grieving wife, but within days, police received a tip from her family, who suspected something was wrong. Detectives searched the Wright home and quickly uncovered the grave in the yard. Inside was Jeff's body, bearing the horrific wounds of the attack. Susan Wright was arrested and charged with first-degree murder. Her trial in 2004 became a media sensation. Prosecutors painted Susan as manipulative and money-driven, saying she killed Jeff to cash in on his life insurance and to free herself for a new life. In a dramatic courtroom demonstration, the prosecution even recreated the crime by tying an actor to a bed and simulating the stabbing to show the jury how brutal it was. Susan's defense told a different story. They argued she was a battered wife who snapped after years of abuse. Susan herself testified that Jeff had beaten and raped her, and that she had acted in fear for her life. The jury deliberated for just 5.5 hours. They rejected the self-defense claim and found Susan Wright guilty of murder. She was sentenced to 25 years in prison. Over the years, Susan appealed, and in 2010, her sentence was reduced to 20 years after a retrial on punishment. She remained behind bars until 2020, when she was paroled after serving 16 years. The case of Susan Wright still divides opinion. Was she a battered woman pushed beyond her limit, or a wife who lured her husband to his death for money? What is certain is that Jeff Wright's murder remains one of the most brutal and infamous spousal killings in Texas history. Number 3, Frances Newton. She was a Texas mother convicted of murdering her entire family for money. Supporters claimed she was innocent, but prosecutors insisted she had planned the killings to collect life insurance. Her name is Frances Newton, and in 2005, she became the third woman executed in Texas since the Civil War. The crime happened on the night of April 7, 1987, in Northwest Houston. Police were called to the apartment Frances shared with her husband, Adrian Newton, and their 21-month-old daughter, Farrah Elaine Newton. Inside, officers found a horrific scene. Adrian, age 23, had been shot once in the head. Farrah had been shot through the chest. In another room, Frances's cousin, Teresa Johnson, age 21, was also found dead from a gunshot wound. At first, Frances told police she had returned home from visiting a relative and discovered the bodies, but investigators quickly grew suspicious. Just weeks earlier, Frances had taken out life insurance policies on Adrian, Farrah, and herself, totaling $100,000. Police also discovered that the murder weapon, a .25-caliber pistol, had been borrowed by Frances from her boyfriend and then hidden at her parents' home after the shootings. Frances was arrested and charged with capital murder. At her 1988 trial, prosecutors argued she killed her family to collect the insurance payouts. They said she shot Adrian while he sat on the couch, then turned the gun on Farrah and Teresa. The jury found her guilty and sentenced her to death. For years, Frances maintained her innocence. She claimed she had no reason to kill her family and that the gun had been planted. Supporters pointed to what they said were problems in the investigation, questions about ballistics, possible contamination of evidence, and whether another man, a drug dealer Adrian reportedly owed money to, could have been responsible. Her case drew attention from human rights organizations and celebrities who argued that Texas was about to execute an innocent woman. The courts, however, repeatedly upheld her conviction. On September 14, 2005, after 18 years on death row, Frances Newton was executed by lethal injection at the Huntsville unit in Texas. She was 40 years old. When asked for final words, she said softly, "I did not do this crime. I would like to say goodbye." She was pronounced dead at 6:17 p.m. The execution of Frances Newton remains one of the most controversial in Texas history. To the state, it was justice for 3 innocent lives. To her supporters, it was a tragic miscarriage of justice that ended with the death of a woman they believe was wrongly convicted. Number 4, Teresa Lewis. She was a 50-year-old woman from Virginia who claimed she was lonely and looking for love. Prosecutors said she was a manipulator who lured men into killing her husband for insurance money. Her name is Teresa Lewis, and in 2010 she became the first woman executed in Virginia in nearly 100 years. The story began in the fall of 2002. Teresa had married Julian Clifton Lewis Jr., a 47-year-old construction foreman. Julian had taken out a $250,000 life insurance policy that named Teresa as the primary beneficiary. Within months, Teresa had also begun an affair with a younger man named Matthew Schallenberger, who was just 21 years old. With Schallenberger's friend, Rodney Fuller, the three began planning Julian's death. Teresa promised them a share of the insurance money if they helped her. On the night of October 30th, 2002, Julian returned home with his 25-year-old son, Charles Lewis. Both men were ambushed in their beds. Schallenberger and Fuller shot them multiple times while Teresa waited in the kitchen. When the police arrived, Teresa pretended to be a shocked and grieving wife. But within days, her story started to unravel. Investigators discovered that Teresa had withdrawn large amounts of cash to buy gifts for the two young men, including clothes, phones, and even weapons. They also learned about her affair with Schallenberger and her plans to split the insurance payout. In 2003, Teresa was arrested and charged with capital murder for hire. At trial, prosecutors described her as the mastermind who manipulated two younger men to carry out the killings while she stayed behind. Teresa's defense argued she was slow-witted and emotionally unstable, with an IQ of 72, placing her in the borderline intellectually disabled range. The jury, however, was unmoved. They convicted her of capital murder and sentenced her to death. Schallenberger and Fuller received life sentences without parole. Over the years, Teresa's case drew international attention. Even the president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, condemned her execution as hypocrisy in America's human rights record. Advocates argued her mental impairments should have spared her the death penalty, but Virginia's courts and governors stood firm. On the evening of September 23, 2010, Teresa Lewis was executed by lethal injection at the Greensville Correctional Center in Jarrett, Virginia. She was 50 years old. When asked for final words, she said quietly, "I just want Kathy to know that I love you, and I am very sorry." She was pronounced dead at 9:13 p.m. Teresa Lewis's execution remains one of the most debated in modern history. To her supporters, she was a flawed and manipulated woman who should never have been sentenced to death. To prosecutors, she was proof that greed can drive even the most unlikely people to orchestrate murder. Number 5. Betty Lou Beets. In the summer of 1983, a retired Dallas firefighter named Jimmy Don Beets vanished while fishing on Lake Athens in Texas. His boat was found drifting, his fishing gear still inside, but he was gone. For years, people believed he had drowned in an accident, but when investigators dug deeper, they uncovered a shocking truth, one that pointed straight to his wife, Betty Lou Beets. Betty was no stranger to hardship. Born in 1937 in North Carolina, she suffered hearing loss as a child, endured sexual abuse, and lived through a string of abusive marriages. By the time she married Jimmy Don, her fifth husband, she was a grandmother who had weathered decades of trauma. But prosecutors argued Betty Lou wasn't just a survivor, she was a killer who saw her husband's death as a payday. On August 6, 1983, Jimmy Don disappeared. For 2 years, his case was considered a mystery on the lake. Then in 1985, investigators returned to Betty Lou's property. Beneath a decorative wishing well in her yard, they made a gruesome discovery: Jimmy Don's body, buried and shot. Even more disturbing, under a nearby storage shed, they found the remains of another man, Doyle Wayne Barker, one of Betty Lou's previous husbands. The evidence was overwhelming. Prosecutors said Betty killed Jimmy Don to collect his life insurance and pension, just as she had killed before. They presented testimony from her own children, some of whom claimed Betty had openly discussed her plans. Her defense painted her as a battered woman, shaped by years of abuse, arguing that she wasn't in full control of her choices. But the jury was unconvinced. In October 1985, Betty Lou Beets was convicted of capital murder and sentenced to death. For 14 years, she lived on death row. Her appeals centered on the argument that her history of abuse hadn't been properly explained to the jury. Advocacy groups for battered women rallied to her cause, but courts and governors rejected every appeal. On February 24, 2000, Betty Lou Beets was executed by lethal injection at the Huntsville unit in Texas. She declined a final meal and offered no last words. She was 62 years old. Her execution made her only the second woman executed in Texas since the Civil War. To some, she was a tragic victim of a violent life who finally lashed out. To others, she was a manipulative killer who buried her husbands in her own backyard for money. Betty Lou Beetz's case still stands out as one of the most chilling examples of how financial gain, and specifically life insurance, can drive even those closest to us to murder. Number 6. Darlene Gentry. It was the early morning of November 9th, 2005, when police in Robinson, Texas, were called to the home of Wayman Keith Gentry, a 31-year-old father of three. He was found in the bedroom, shot once in the head at close range. At first, it looked like a home invasion gone wrong, but detectives soon noticed that valuables were untouched and several guns had been neatly stacked by the door. Something about the scene didn't add up. Darlene was a nurse, a mother, and by all outward appearances, a loving wife. But prosecutors would later show another side. Just weeks before Keith's death, she had taken out life insurance policies totaling about $750,000 on him. Investigators began digging into her story, and the pieces quickly fell into place. She had purchased cleaning supplies and even attempted to build a homemade silencer, but the most incriminating evidence came while she was out on bond. Investigators had pulled Keith's missing handgun from a pond near her home, and when they set up surveillance, they captured Darlene on video, wading into that same pond in rubber boots, probing the water to make sure the gun was gone. In 2007, Darlene went on trial for murder. Prosecutors told the jury that she shot her husband as he slept, motivated by greed and the promise of insurance money. They played the pond video for the jury, a piece of evidence so powerful it erased any doubt. After only a few hours of deliberation, Darlene Gentry was found guilty of murder and sentenced to 60 years in prison. Today, she remains behind bars in a Texas state prison. Her three sons were left without their father and without their mother, who chose money over family and destroyed them both in the process. Number 7. Lynn Turner. Few killers managed to fool doctors and investigators twice, but in Georgia, one woman did just that, poisoning two husbands years apart, both of them law enforcement officers. Her name was Lynn Turner, and her crimes shocked the state for their cold calculation and their unusual choice of weapon, antifreeze. Lynn Marie Womack was born in April 1968. By the mid-90s, she was married to Glenn Turner, a 31-year-old Cobb County police officer. They had two children together, but the marriage was turbulent. Friends later testified that Lynn had become controlling and obsessed with money. Glenn began talking about leaving her. In March 1995, Glenn suddenly fell ill. He experienced nausea, vomiting, and fatigue symptoms doctors initially thought were flu or heart problems. On March 3rd, he was found dead. His death certificate listed cardiac arrhythmia, and no autopsy was performed. Lynn collected his insurance benefits and police death payout, totaling more than $150,000. Years later, Lynn began a relationship with Randy Thompson, a 22-year-old firefighter from Forsyth County. They moved in together, but soon, the same pattern emerged. Arguments, money problems, and Randy confiding to friends that he feared her temper. In January 2001, Randy developed the same mysterious symptoms Glenn had once shown. On January 22nd, he was found unresponsive in his recliner and pronounced dead. Again, doctors were puzzled, but this time his mother pressed for answers. A toxicology test revealed the truth. Ethylene glycol, the sweet-tasting chemical in antifreeze, was in Randy's system. Investigators reopened Glenn Turner's case, exhumed his body, and discovered the same poison. In 2004, Lynn Turner was indicted for Randy Thompson's murder. At trial, prosecutors presented the medical evidence and pointed to her financial motives, insurance payouts, death benefits, and her mounting debt. They also argued that the similarities between Glenn and Randy's deaths were no coincidence. The jury agreed. In 2004, Lynn Turner was convicted of murdering Randy Thompson and sentenced to life in prison. 3 years later, in 2007, she faced trial for Glenn Turner's death. Once again, the evidence of antifreeze poisoning was clear. She was convicted and received a second life sentence. But her story ended abruptly. On August 30th, 2010, Lynn Turner was found dead in her prison cell at the Metro State Women's Prison in Atlanta. She had overdosed on blood pressure medication. Her death was ruled a suicide. She was 41 years old. Lynn Turner's case is remembered as one of Georgia's most shocking, a woman who poisoned not one, but two law enforcement husbands, both men trusting her until the very end. Number 8. Brenda Andrew. It was the evening of November 26th, 2001, in a quiet Oklahoma City neighborhood. Rob Andrew, a well-respected advertising executive, pulled his car into the garage after attending church with his two children. Moments later, shotgun blasts tore through the night. Rob collapsed, fatally wounded. His wife, Brenda Andrew, was also hit, a superficial wound to her arm. At first, it looked like a violent burglary. But investigators soon uncovered the truth. This was an ambush, carefully planned, with Brenda at the center. Brenda was born in 1963 and raised in Oklahoma. By her 30s, she was married to Rob Andrew, and together they had two children. Outwardly, their life looked stable. But prosecutors would later show another side. Brenda was deeply involved in an affair with James Pavat, a former insurance agent who had helped the couple secure policies worth nearly $800,000. With Rob gone, Brenda and Pavat stood to share the payout. The investigation revealed that the supposed burglary had been staged. Nothing valuable was missing. Instead, witnesses came forward to testify about Brenda's relationship with Pavat and her growing financial problems. Even more damning, prosecutors found evidence that Brenda had lured Rob to the house under false pretenses that night, setting him up for the fatal attack. After the murder, Brenda and Pavat fled to Mexico with her children, living under assumed names. Their capture only fueled the media firestorm around the case. In 2004, Brenda went on trial for Rob Andrew's murder. The prosecution portrayed her as manipulative and cold, willing to kill her husband for money and passion. They told jurors how she tried to appear as a victim, even shooting herself lightly in the arm to sell the story. The jury was not convinced. Brenda Andrew was found guilty of first-degree murder and conspiracy. She was sentenced to death, becoming the only woman on Oklahoma's death row. Her lover, James Pavat, received the same sentence. To this day, Brenda Andrew continues to appeal her conviction from prison. Supporters argue she deserves another look, while victims' advocates insist the evidence speaks for itself. Her case remains one of Oklahoma's most infamous. A mother and wife who turned her own garage into a murder scene, sacrificing her husband for insurance money and the promise of forbidden love. Number 9. Uloma Walker Curry. Greed and desperation, those were the words prosecutors used to describe Uloma Walker Curry, a 45-year-old nurse from Cleveland, Ohio. Facing mounting debts and a failing marriage, she plotted to have her husband murdered so she could cash in on his life insurance. But her plan quickly unraveled, and it was her own words that sealed her fate. The victim was William Walker, 38 years old, a Cleveland firefighter who had only been married to Uloma for 4 months. In November 2013, William was shot to death in his driveway as he prepared to go on a late-night fast food run at Uloma's request. Police soon learned that the shooting had been no random act. Uloma had conspired with her teenage daughter's boyfriend and several of his friends, persuading them to carry out the killing with promises of cash once she received the life insurance payout. But there was a fatal flaw in her scheme. Uloma did not realize that William had never updated his life insurance policy to include her. His ex-wife remained the listed beneficiary. That meant Uloma stood to gain nothing from his death. The plot began to unravel almost immediately. The teenage accomplices confessed and cooperated with investigators, providing text messages and testimony that linked Uloma directly to the murder for hire. Prosecutors also introduced evidence that she had complained about her debts and openly talked about needing William out of the way. In July 2017, after a highly publicized trial, Uloma Walker Curry was convicted of aggravated murder, conspiracy, and other charges. The judge sentenced her to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Today, she remains incarcerated in an Ohio state prison, serving a sentence that ensures she will never walk free again. Her case is remembered as one of Ohio's most cold-blooded spousal murders, a woman who recruited teenagers to kill her husband for money, only to learn that her greed left her with nothing but a life sentence. Number 10. Jennifer Lynn Faith. It was just after 7:30 in the morning on October 9th, 2020, in Dallas, Texas. Jamie Faith, a 49-year-old American Airlines technology director, stepped outside his Oak Cliff home with his wife, Jennifer Lynn Faith, to take their dog for a walk. Moments later, gunfire erupted. Jamie was shot 7 times at close range by a masked gunman right in front of his wife. Neighbors rushed out to find Jennifer screaming for help. At first, she appeared to be a devastated widow. But within weeks, investigators uncovered a story of deception, greed, and betrayal with Jennifer at the center. Detectives traced the crime to Darren Lopez, a Tennessee man who had been Jennifer's high school sweetheart decades earlier. The two had reconnected online during the COVID-19 pandemic, and Jennifer began feeding him a steady stream of lies. She told Lopez that Jamie was violent and abusive, that she was trapped, and that she needed saving. In reality, Jamie was described by friends and co-workers as gentle and kind. Jennifer manipulated Lopez into becoming her killer. Phone records, emails, and text messages revealed she had begged him to come to Texas, stage an attack, and remove Jamie from her life. At the same time, prosecutors said, Jennifer stood to benefit from nearly $629,000 in life insurance policies taken out on her husband. The investigation moved quickly. Surveillance cameras captured Lopez's black pickup truck near the crime scene. Bank records showed Jennifer had transferred thousands of dollars to him before and after the murder. She even used her work email to coordinate parts of the plan, assuming no one would suspect her. In September 2021, Jennifer Faith was arrested. Facing overwhelming evidence, she eventually accepted a plea deal. In February 2022, she was sentenced to life in federal prison for her role in the murder-for-hire plot. Darren Lopez was also arrested and charged with carrying out the killing. His case remains pending, but prosecutors have made clear they intend to seek a severe penalty. The murder of Jamie Faith stunned Dallas not just for its brutality, but for the betrayal behind it. A wife who pretended to be grieving on television interviews while secretly orchestrating her husband's execution for money and an old flame. Jennifer Faith's name is now etched into the long list of black widow cases, women who turned marriage into murder, sacrificing love and family for greed. Number 11, Monica Cementilli. In Los Angeles, murders tied to the entertainment industry always draw headlines, but this case was different. The victim wasn't a movie star or a singer, he was Fabio Cementilli, a 50-year-old celebrity hairstylist who worked with A-list clients and served as an executive for Wella, one of the biggest names in beauty. His death shocked Hollywood, and the woman accused of orchestrating it was his wife, Monica Cementilli. On January 23, 2017, Fabio was found stabbed to death on the patio of his Woodland Hills home. At first, police believed it was a robbery gone wrong. His Porsche had been stolen, and the house showed signs of disturbance, but detectives quickly began to suspect that the crime scene had been staged. The truth came out over time. Investigators discovered that Fabio's wife, Monica, had been having an affair with a man named Robert Baker. Together, the two had plotted Fabio's death. The motive? A $1.6 million life insurance policy. Detectives pieced together evidence from surveillance footage, cell phone records, and financial documents. They alleged that Monica and Baker had planned the murder carefully, using the stolen Porsche as a cover story for a supposed burglary. For years, the case moved slowly through the California courts. Monica maintained her innocence, while Baker awaited trial as her alleged accomplice. But in 2025, Monica Cementilli was convicted of orchestrating her husband's murder. Prosecutors called it a classic black widow case, a wife who killed for money and a lover. Her sentencing brought closure to Fabio's family, friends, and the hairstyling community, who had mourned him as a generous mentor and creative force. The Cementilli case stands out for its unusual mix of Hollywood glamour and brutal betrayal. A man who built his reputation making others look beautiful was struck down in his own backyard, all because of greed, infidelity, and the promise of insurance money. Number 12, Barbara Passa. On the night of May 5th, 2018, a fire tore through a home in Centerville, Iowa. Inside, firefighters discovered the body of Tim Passa, 50 years old, lying in bed. His wife, Barbara Passa, a local nurse, had escaped unharmed. At first, it looked like a tragic accident, a house fire that claimed a husband's life. but investigators quickly realized that the blaze was no accident. An autopsy revealed something chilling. Tim had no smoke in his lungs. He had died before the fire even started. The flames were a cover-up. Detectives soon learned that Barbara had recently taken out a $200,000 life insurance policy on her husband, and financial records showed she was struggling with debt. Arson investigators found traces of accelerants in the bedroom where Tim's body was discovered. They also uncovered evidence that Barbara had given conflicting statements about the night of the fire. Witnesses testified that she had been researching insurance benefits and had even spoken about her financial problems in the weeks before her husband's death. In June 2019, Barbara was arrested and charged with first-degree murder and arson. At trial, prosecutors argued she had drugged or incapacitated Tim, set the fire to make it look like an accident, and stood to gain financially once the insurance payout came through. The defense countered that Barbara was a grieving widow being unfairly targeted, but the evidence told another story. In October 2019, a jury found Barbara Pasa guilty. She was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Today, Barbara sits in an Iowa women's prison, serving a life sentence. Her case stands as a reminder of how far greed can push someone, a wife who betrayed her husband in the most brutal way, trading his life for a policy worth $200,000. Number 13, Curry Richens. Money, power, and control. That's how prosecutors describe the motive in one of Utah's most shocking recent cases. At the center is Curry Darden Richens, a real estate agent and mother of three, accused of poisoning her husband to collect millions in life insurance. On the night of March 3, 2022, Curry and her husband, Eric Eugene Richens, celebrated the closing of a new home she had purchased for her business. She later told investigators they shared a Moscow Mule cocktail before bed. In the early hours of March 4th, she dialed 911, saying Eric was cold and unresponsive. Paramedics found him on the bedroom floor, and he was pronounced dead at 3:31 a.m. An autopsy revealed he had ingested a dose of fentanyl 5 times the lethal limit. Medical experts noted the fentanyl was not pharmaceutical grade, but illicit, and that it had been ingested orally. Eric was just 39 years old. The investigation that followed uncovered a troubling financial backdrop. Between 2015 and 2017, prosecutors say Curry had quietly taken out at least 4 life insurance policies on Eric, with combined death benefits totaling nearly $1,947,000. In January 2022, she attempted to change a $2 million policy on Eric and his business partner to make herself the sole beneficiary. The insurance company flagged it, and the men reversed the change. A month later, in February, another application was filed for a new $100,000 policy on Eric. Detectives also discovered what they believe were earlier poisoning attempts. On Valentine's Day 2022, Eric fell violently ill after eating a sandwich his wife had brought him. He broke out in hives, struggled to breathe, and used his son's EpiPen to recover. He later told friends he thought he had been poisoned. Just 3 weeks later, after celebrating the new house purchase, he was dead. Witness testimony strengthened the case against Curry. A housekeeper told investigators that Curry had asked her to obtain the Michael Jackson stuff, a reference to lethal drugs. The housekeeper described arranging fentanyl purchases for Curry in February and March of that year. Financial records also showed that Eric had moved assets into a trust for his children in 2020, reducing Curry's direct control. Investigators argued that she saw insurance money and financial freedom in Eric's death. In May 2023, Curry Richens was arrested and charged with aggravated murder and multiple drug-related counts. Prosecutors later added attempted murder and fraud. She has pleaded not guilty and remains in custody while awaiting trial, which is scheduled for February 2026. The state has confirmed they will not seek the death penalty. The case drew worldwide attention because, 1 year after Eric's death, Curry published a children's book titled Are You With Me?, designed to help children process grief. To prosecutors, the book was not a comfort, but a chilling move, capitalizing on the very loss she is accused of causing. Eric Richens was remembered in his obituary as a devoted father, a son, and a friend. Born on May 13, 1982, his life was cut short at 39 years old. His family has since spoken publicly, saying their priority is to protect his three young sons and preserve his memory. Khoury's fate will be decided in a courtroom, but to prosecutors, the picture is already clear. A celebration drink turned into poison, and a marriage ended in betrayal. Driven by greed and the lure of life insurance. Number 14. Karina Cooper. It was a calm June night in 2021 when shots rang out in the home Karina Cooper shared with her husband. Ryan Cooper, 42 years old, lay in a recliner, shot twice in the face. Deputies found his body there, Karina sitting atop him, three of their children in the house. No gun was recovered at the scene, but a single .22-caliber shell casing was. Investigators would later say this wasn't a random killing. It was murder planned by the person who claimed to love him. Karina Sue Cooper, 48 at trial, ran a hair salon in Traer, Iowa. Prosecutors painted her life before the crime as outwardly normal: wife, mother, small business owner. But they revealed another side. Documents and testimony showed she and Huston Danker, a client lover, were communicating about starting a life together. In court, prosecutors presented Snapchat messages where they discussed marriage, IVF, and meeting secretly in early 2021. When Ryan was killed on June 18, 2021, Karina was arrested years later in February 2024. The prosecution's case hinged on a life insurance policy taken out years earlier. In December 2020, Karina received a payout of $514,882.21 from his life insurance, according to court filings and reporting. In court, deputies testified that the body was found in a recliner and that Karina had been interviewed in the house. She claimed she found him dead. But forensic evidence told a different story. Blood spatter, trajectories, and digital forensics placed Karina and Danker in coordinated message exchanges minutes before the fatal shots. Witnesses testified that the two had exchanged texts referencing "remember those shell casings" shortly before the shooting. In July 2025, a jury found Karina Cooper guilty of first-degree murder, and in September 2025, she was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Iowa law mandates that punishment for first-degree murder is a life sentence. She will also pay over $165,000 in restitution. Ryan's estate, now led by his siblings, filed legal motions to claw back the life insurance funds using Iowa's Slayer statute, which prohibits a person who causes another's death from benefiting from their life insurance. The estate seeks to freeze or reclaim any remaining sums. Karina Cooper's case is now etched into Iowa's legal and crime history. A small-town salon owner who once appeared devoted turned into a defendant convicted of cold betrayal. The texts, the money, the secret meetings, they all mapped out a plot to kill the man she claimed to share a life with. Number 15. Kane Kijima. In Japan, death sentences for women are rare, and even rarer when a jury of lay citizens helps deliver the verdict. That is what makes the case of Kanae Kijima so striking. Prosecutors said she hunted for love and money on Konkatsu marriage sites, then turned romance into a weapon. By the time the investigation ended, three men were dead, each scene staged to look like suicide or a tragic accident, and Kijima stood convicted and sentenced to death. The first death that would later anchor the case was Takao Terada, a 53-year-old salaryman living in Omi, Tokyo. On January 30, 2009, Terada was found dead at home. The cause was carbon monoxide poisoning from charcoal briquettes. In the days before he died, 17 million yen had moved from his account into Kijima's. No forced entry, no struggle, just a quiet room, and a life ended by gas. 4 months later came Kenzo Ando, 80, in Noda, Chiba. On May 15, 2009, a fire gutted his house. Investigators would later tell the court that charcoal briquettes had been set to burn inside, turning the air itself into poison. After Ando's death, Kijima withdrew 1.9 million yen from his bank account and stole paintings from the home valuable works tied to Ando's family. The flames hid the method, not the motive. The third case was Yoshiyuki Oide, 41. On August 6, 2009, he was found in a rental car parked in a Saitama lot, a charcoal stove smoldering nearby. The door was shut. The windows sealed a common scene in staged suicides. Prosecutors said Kijima had posed as his future bride, taking about 4.7 million yen from him before he died. The pattern had become impossible to ignore. A woman, a promise of marriage, money moving into her hands, and then death by carbon monoxide. Police reopened earlier suspicious deaths, and fraud charges landed first. But the murder indictments followed, and in 2012, Kijima faced a lay judge trial that lasted about 100 days. There were no confessions. Instead, prosecutors built the case brick by brick, purchases of charcoal and sleeping pills, last sightings with each victim, and money flowing to Kijima. The defense argued suicide and accident. The court called it premeditated murder. The verdict was death. Appeals did not change the outcome. The Tokyo High Court upheld the sentence in 2014. In 2017, Japan's Supreme Court affirmed it, calling the killings intentional and extremely malicious, and noting the defendant showed no remorse. Kanai Kijima remains on death row. One important clarification: unlike some Black Widow cases, the public record in Kijima's convictions does not show life insurance payouts. The financial gain came through bank transfers, withdrawals after death, and theft. If insurance played any role in related suspicions, it is not part of the three murder convictions that sent her to death row. Number 16, Helen Milner. It wasn't a detective who first broke the case open. It was a sister. In Christchurch, New Zealand, Leanne Cartier refused to accept that her brother, Phil Nisbet, had taken his own life. She gathered documents, messages, and the fragments of a marriage that had been coming apart. And when a coroner looked again, the story shifted from suicide to a calculated killing staged by a wife for money. Phil was 47 years old, a truck driver who worked long shifts and kept a small circle. On May 4, 2009, he was found dead. At first, the explanation fit too neatly: a suicide note, an unhappy man, a tidy conclusion. But the people who knew Phil pushed back, and soon the science did too. Tests pointed to promethazine, an antihistamine sold as Phenergan. The Crown said Helen Milner drugged him to incapacity and may have finished the job by smothering him. Earlier in April, there had been two health crises that now looked like trial runs. Behind the scenes was money. Prosecutors told jurors Milner stood to gain a $250,000 life insurance payout, and counting injury compensation, roughly $336,000 overall. They said she lied to police about the policy, and when that didn't move things fast enough, she tried something bolder: offering her son and his girlfriend a cut if they could find a $5,000 hitman. The girlfriend took the stand and repeated the offer in court. The suicide details also began to crumble. The note Milner produced was challenged as a forgery. Phone evidence and witness accounts showed a woman researching poisons, crushing blue and white capsules, and pushing a narrative of a depressed husband that didn't match his recent plans. Initially, police accepted suicide, only after coroner Sue Johnson flagged inconsistencies and after Leanne Cartier kept pressing, did homicide investigators re-enter the picture. In December 2013, a high court jury found Helen Milner guilty of murdering Phil Nisbet and of one count of attempted murder tied to an earlier poisoning attempt. In February 2014, the judge imposed life imprisonment with a minimum non-parole period of 17 years, calling it a carefully planned killing for financial gain. Milner's appeals failed. The conviction and sentence stood. The image of a grieving widow dissolved under evidence. The drug purchases, the staged note, the money waiting on the other side of a death declared suicide. What remained was the picture of a man who didn't write that final message, a sister who would not let the file close, and a court that decided this was murder, carried out for money and disguised as despair. Number 17, Thandi Makwela. She was once described as stylish, poised, and determined. the wife of a high court judge, with everything to lose. But when Patrick Makwela died in his Cape Town apartment, investigators would later argue that behind her composed exterior lay a plot born of betrayal, deception, and greed. Her name is Thandi Cheryl Makbela, and her legal saga became one of South Africa's most controversial cases. The body of Judge Patrick Makwela was discovered on June 7, 2009, in his Bantry Bay flat, his face covered by a bloodied pillow, wrapped in a sheet. For days, few suspected foul play. The initial ruling leaned toward natural causes or a heart attack, but over time, cell phone records, witness testimonies, and legal filings would expose a case far more complicated than it first appeared. Her critics said the motive was clear. In the years before his death, Patrick had told friends he intended to divorce her. Meanwhile, documents presented at trial showed Thandi had changed his cell phone usage, appeared in control of communications, and manipulated perceptions of his movements. Courtroom testimony argued she had the means and motive to benefit financially. One media report suggested she stood to gain from a 20 million rand life insurance policy or estate control. But that claim was never definitively proven in court. In the Western Cape High Court in November 2013, Judge John Murphy presided over a sensational trial. The prosecution did not present a conclusive medical cause of death, but argued that Thandi's conduct, her lies, her false accounts, her manipulation of communication records, excluded natural death as the only reasonable inference. They also confronted evidence that she had submitted a forged will in Patrick's name, intending to disinherit his children and benefit herself. The state theorized that after incapacitating Patrick, she smothered him with cling film in his bedroom. The jury found her guilty on charges of murder, forgery, and fraud. Murphy sentenced her to 15 years in prison for murder, with concurrent sentences on other counts, yielding an effective term of 18 years in total. But Thandi made Makwela's fight was not over. She appealed. On September 29, 2017, the Supreme Court of Appeal overturned her murder conviction. The High Court had applied the wrong standard needing scientific certainty when the law requires probability. The SCA held that a reasonable inference of natural death could not be excluded. Her convictions for forgery and fraud remained intact. Her ordeal left a divided legacy. To some, she was a victim of marital betrayal. To others, a manipulator who escaped the full weight of her verdict. What remains indisputable is that Patrick Makbela's death has never been scientifically resolved, and that the courts found the evidence against her legally insufficient to sustain a murder conviction under the proper standard. Number 18, Catherine Nevin. She was known across Ireland as the Black Widow, the pub owner's wife who ordered her husband's death and manipulated a crime scene to look like a botched robbery. Her name is Catherine Scully Nevin, and when she was convicted in the year 2000, her trial became one of the most infamous in Irish legal history. Tom Nevin, aged 55, was shot dead early in the morning of March 19, 1996 inside his own pub, Jack White's Inn in British Bay, County Wicklow. He had been counting the previous weekend's takings when a single shotgun blast hit him. Gardaí were called to the pub around 4:35 a.m., following a panic alarm and reports of a break-in. When arriving, officers found Catherine on the floor behind the front door, her wrists bound, gagged, claiming she had been attacked by a masked intruder pushing a pillow over her face. The scene was chaotic, doors ajar, jewelry strewn, and some cash missing, roughly 13,000 Irish pounds taken from the pub. The family car had vanished and was later found abandoned in Dublin. But that narrative didn't hold. Detectives found no signs of forced entry except the front door. None of the windows had been tampered with. No fingerprints other than Catherine's were on the jewelry box that had been emptied, and no thefts occurred upstairs. The layout didn't fit a robbery. Instead, it looked staged. She chose not to search for Tom or raise an alarm by phone, but instead hit the panic button at the front door. That raised suspicion. Investigators pieced together a darker motive: money and power. The Nevin couple owned the pub and real estate. Some reports say that 78,000 Irish pounds in insurance proceeds and 620,000 pounds from property were contested after Tom's death. Catherine's siblings later argued that some parts of the estate were improperly awarded. Catherine had a wholly different story. She claimed a gang had burst in, tied her up, demanded jewelry, forced her into the bedroom, bound her wrists with nylons, and fled. She blamed her husband's death on intruders. She also asserted that Tom was abusive, that he had threatened her, and that she couldn't have plotted such a crime. The trial opened in early 2000 at the Central Criminal Court in Dublin. Over the course of 61 days, the court heard from 170 witnesses. Catherine was also charged with soliciting three men in the years preceding the murder. Prosecutors argued she eagerly planned a contract killing. After 5 days of jury deliberation, Catherine Nevin was found guilty, unanimously, of murdering her husband and of the soliciting charges. She received life imprisonment, the mandatory sentence under Irish law. Additional sentences on solicitation counts were also handed down. Over the next years, Catherine appealed. She attempted to have her conviction declared a miscarriage of justice, including arguments over secret Garda files, inadequate disclosure, and that her trial had been influenced by media sensationalism. But courts repeatedly denied her claims. She remained in prison. In late 2017, Catherine Nevin was released on compassionate grounds after being diagnosed with a brain tumor. She died on February 19, 2018, aged 67. Catherine Nevin's name lives on in Irish true crime lore, a woman whose life of public influence turned into a sensational courtroom drama. She killed her husband, they said, in a staged robbery. She denied it to the end, even attempting to slander his character and accuse him of IRA affiliations. Her trial, with its cocktail of murder, conspiracy, power, and media frenzy, remains a template for Black Widow narratives in Ireland. Though the records don't clearly confirm a direct life insurance scheme as motive, the estate and financial fallout were deeply entangled with her conviction. The question of whether money alone drove her hand remains a shadow in her story, but the verdict remains. Number 19, Melissa Ann Shepherd. They thought she was a blessing, a kind widow offering comfort and company to men who had already buried their wives. What they didn't know was that every man who let her in would lose more than love. Her name was Melissa Ann Shepherd, but she went by many: Melissa Weeks, Melissa Friedrich, Melissa Stewart, the internet Black Widow. Her first husband, Gordon Stewart, was 44 when he met her in Halifax in the early 1990s. Within a year, he was dead. On April 13, 1991, Gordon was struck twice by a car near Halifax Airport. Toxicology showed he had high levels of benzodiazepines in his blood. Melissa told police she had been raped and drove over him by accident while fleeing in panic. Prosecutors said otherwise, that she drugged him, ran him down deliberately, and tried to pass it off as self-defense. In 1992, she was convicted of manslaughter and sentenced to 6 years. She served just two before parole. No record ever surfaced of a life insurance payout. The motive was about control and money in hand. By 2000, she had reinvented herself in the United States under another name. She married Robert Friedrich, a wealthy widower from Florida she met through a Christian dating site. 14 months later, he was dead. No charges were filed in his death, but his son sued her in civil court, recovering about $15,000 she had moved into her own accounts. Again, the pattern: an ailing husband, suspicious drugs, and missing money. In 2005, Shepherd was in Florida again, living with another man she'd met online. He was repeatedly hospitalized, doctors finding sedatives in his system. This time, prosecutors had enough. She was convicted of grand theft, forgery, and using a forged document, serving 5 years in a Florida prison. Then she returned to Canada and struck again. In September 2012, she married Fred Weeks, a 75-year-old widower from Nova Scotia. On their honeymoon at a Cape Breton bed and breakfast, Fred collapsed. Police found sedatives lorazepam and temazepam in his system and in Melissa's purse. She was arrested for attempted murder. The charge was later reduced to administering a noxious substance and fraud, and she was sentenced to 3.5 years. When she was released in 2016, police across Canada issued a rare warning. Melissa Ann Shepherd was a high-risk offender, likely to target older men online again. Within months, she breached her parole conditions by using the internet under a false name and found herself back in custody. Across three decades, she left a trail from Nova Scotia to Florida and back. Men drugged, defrauded, and in one case, killed. Unlike other black widows, she never used a weapon or a fire. Her weapon was trust built carefully through letters, phone calls, and wedding vows. Melissa Ann Shepherd's story is a study in quiet manipulation. No gunfire, no violence in public view, just pills, forged signatures, and the kind of charm that convinced lonely men she was safety, not danger. They called her the Internet Black Widow, and by the time anyone realized why, she was already searching for the next man who believed in second chances. Number 20, Barbara Cogan. It was a clear Tuesday morning on the Upper East Side, October 23, 1990, when George Cogan, 49 years old, walked along East 69th Street, carrying groceries, to the apartment of his girlfriend, Mary Louise Hawkins, a 29-year-old publicist he'd begun seeing after separating from his wife. A man in a green baseball cap stepped behind him and fired. George was hit three times and rushed to the hospital, where he died not long after. As police worked the scene, his estranged wife, Barbara Cogan, was not at the hospital. Prosecutors later said she called a stylist and had her hair done for $500 that same day. The investigation quickly found its center of gravity in the couple's bitter divorce. George, a successful antiques and art dealer who'd grown up in Puerto Rico before moving to New York, was in the process of dividing assets. Barbara had sought $5,000 per week in support. A judge had rejected that request. Detectives also learned she stood to benefit from substantial life insurance policies on George's life. Credible reporting places the total between $4 million and $4.3 million. For years, the case stalled. Then, nearly 18 years after the shooting, a break. Barbara's divorce lawyer, Manuel Martinez, was indicted and tried for arranging the hit. Prosecutors said Barbara and Martinez flew to Puerto Rico, borrowed $100,000, and used it to fund the contract killing. In 2008, a Manhattan jury convicted Martinez. He was sentenced to 25 years to life. The suspected triggerman was identified in court and in later accounts as Paul Tony Pro Prosano, but he was never charged in the Cogan murder. Barbara was arrested in 2008. In 2010, as part of a plea agreement, she admitted orchestrating the contract killing and pleaded guilty to manslaughter with related counts. She received 12 to 36 years in state prison. Even after sentencing, the financial trail lingered over the case. During a 2020 parole hearing, Barbara acknowledged that she had spent all of the insurance proceeds, the same multi-million dollar payout cited in the original motive before her arrest. That fall, she was paroled after serving roughly 12 years. Hawkins, the girlfriend who watched George die outside her building, urged the board to deny release. The board granted it anyway. In court, prosecutors called it what it was, a murder for money, arranged by a spouse who preferred a payout to a settlement. In the years since, the case has been retold as a quintessential New York black widow story, not because of theatrics, but because the facts are plain. A man walking home with groceries, a marriage collapsing into a contract, a lawyer turned broker, a gunman who vanished, and a paper trail of insurance that outlived them all. Behind every ring was a promise, and behind every promise, a motive. Which of these stories stayed with you the longest? Share your thoughts in the comments, and if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe for more true stories that test the limits of loyalty, greed, and human darkness.